You're listening to 90.3 WESS East Stroudsburg University, Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. And today we have a special broadcast as one of our very own, Anya Whitehead, is going to interview our One Book, One Campus author, Jeanette Walls. It's pretty exciting. Let's get down to it. Instead of Devil's Advocate today, it'll be this interview. So tune in and stay tuned for a great interview with Anya and Walls.
All right. Thank you, Shane. So let's get right down to it. You've had a very interesting life, as I've read from your book. What made you decide to write a memoir?
There were a couple of things. I was covering celebrities, and the irony, or some would say hypocrisy, of writing about other people's secrets while I was hiding my own haunted me. And then the time that I saw my mother in the street, and I opened the book with that because it was so jarring to have my two worlds collide like that, and to have her either challenge me or give me permission to just tell the truth. It's such an elegant and simple challenge, but it felt like I couldn't rise to the occasion, but I had to.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. When you were writing the book, did, like, what problems, like, did your family, were they supportive of it?
You know, I offered to show the manuscript to everybody in my family. My brother was the only one who was interested in reading it. He was fabulous. He's got this steel trap memory. And it's funny because he sees things differently than I do. Would remember the same incident, but he's a little bit more of a realist than I am. There was one scene in the book where my hand was licked by a cheetah, and my husband was reading an early version. He said, "Jeanette, did this really happen?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Yeah, I remember it really vividly." He said, "A cheetah licked your hand?" I said, "That sort of thing happened all the time." He said, "Not in most families, Jeanette. Are you sure about this?" I thought, is this one of those weird, like, made-up memories? So I called my brother. I said, "Brian, remember that time that cheetah licked off my hand, that really beautiful, gorgeous cheetah?" He said, "That wasn't a beautiful, gorgeous cheetah. That was a mangy, flea-bitten critter." So, you know, it's interesting in writing nonfiction. You know, there's a lot of discussion about how much leeway memoirists can use. And, you know, my brother is more of a realist than I am.
Yeah.
I tend to be a little bit more rosy-eyed than he is, but it still has to be a cheetah. You know, it wasn't a barracuda. So, but Brian was fabulous from day one. And since the book's come out, they've all been lovely. Though my older sister is, you know, she finds the past a little more painful than I do and doesn't understand why I would want to keep on revisiting it. My kid sister is the most emotionally troubled of us, but she loves the book as well. So everybody's been great about it.
Was there anybody that wasn't supportive of it?
If so, they haven't told me.
I
suppose if I have one regret about this book, I wish I hadn't named my college professor, Professor Fuchs, who, when she asked me what I knew about poor people and the homeless, I said, "You're right," and I shut up. And a couple of people said, "You really stuck it to Professor Fuchs, didn't you?" And I didn't mean to stick it to anybody. Professor Fuchs was one of the reasons I became a political science major. She asked tough questions, and she was challenging me. I actually did a talk at Barnard, and I wanted to apologize to her, and she didn't show up, so I don't know if she's forgiven me. But but nobody who I've written about has had any problem with it. Like I said, at least as far as I know.
Yeah, that's wonderful, because it's not only invasive of you, but like your whole family.
Exactly.
So.
And that's one of the challenges in telling your story. It's one thing to expose yourself, but to bring in the people who you love and care about, and a lot of people who are grappling with writing memoirs ask me, how do you deal with that? Because I'm a big advocate of telling stories. I think that people, so many of us are walking around with these amazing stories that we're kind of ashamed of. And I urge people to get it out, whether it's through fiction or nonfiction. But, you know, people say, well, what can I do about my family? And one of the ways to deal with that is if you've got a great story, just turn it into fiction. Or you can change people's names. There are plenty of ways around it. You don't have to expose or humiliate your family, and I believe that if the story is told with compassion and concern, there's not that many bad guys out there. If you keep on digging, somebody might look like a bad guy from the beginning. And then you know, my father was an alcoholic. There were so many things wrong with him. But there were reasons for that. I don't blame him for his problems.
Exactly. Yeah. And touching upon that, what was it like for you living in a household like that with an alcoholic father, mm-hmm. an abusive father? Not towards you guys, mm-hmm. mostly towards your mother, but how was that growing up? Did that have an effect on you in your life now?
Oh, yeah. I think that, you know, my brother is, he's got this incredible ability to see problems. When he was a cop, he could scan the horizon. There's a drug deal going on. That person's a crook. And I have a little bit of that, too. And it's a form of post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. I can spot a pathological liar from a mile away. And maybe it may be a tenacious reporter. I definitely have issues from the past. But I think I also have some blessings from the past. I think the things that scare other people don't really bother me. Mm-hmm. And that can be a good thing. My current husband is a lovely, waspy individual who taught me how to ski and sail. But when there's a snake in the basement, he's like, honey, little big wicked looking snake down. I'm like, that's no problem. That's a black snake. You just catch it like this. And he's turning all white and I just toss it into the yard. You know? So there's an upside.
Yeah, of course. I see. I can understand that. That's very interesting. Speaking of you and the way you handle mm-hmm. the past, mm-hmm. you seem very to make everything a lesson. It wasn't ever mm-hmm. like you were down about mm-hmm. the things that you went through, which most people would get down about.
You know, Anya, I think the worst experience in the world has a valuable gift wrapped inside if you're willing to receive that gift. And very often that gift is a lesson. Mm-hmm. Very often, you know, a lesson is what we get when we didn't get what we really wanted.
Exactly.
If we don't learn from our mistakes and from the bad things that happen to us, it's just an unpleasant experience. Mm-hmm. I ride horses now, and my instructor says, pain is a very valuable teacher. Mm-hmm. So when something painful happens to you, you look back and say, what went wrong? How do I make sure this doesn't happen again? I don't want to be a victim. I don't want to be, you know, I am not, I refuse to be somebody who is beat up in life and things are always going wrong. So you learn from these bad things. And that is why, you know, you take these things and you use them as stepping stones and sort of to get you from one place to another. Otherwise, it would have killed you. Mm-hmm. It killed me, you know, to just, oh, these awful things keep happening to me. No, actually. And I don't believe that if what doesn't kill you will make you stronger. That I disagree with Nietzsche. I think it can also cripple you. Mm-hmm. And there are many people who are crippled and broken down by the experience of a very tough life. But if you take those things as an experience and say, I'm going to watch out for people like that in the past. Now, I overlearned some of my lessons. And my first husband, I chose because he was the polar opposite of my father. So I was sort of like, I'm not going to marry anybody who I'm attracted to. I'm not going to, if he makes me squishy, I'm not going to marry him. So I it was a little bit of a pendulum. I was overreacting. But life is a constant lesson. You know, and as a university student, you know, you'll learn many things here while you're here, beautiful lessons. But I think the most valuable thing that you'll take away is the ability to keep on learning, to like just life will be your university. And that's you get amazing tools while you're at university, but you go on from there and you keep on learning.
That's really inspiring. I like that. Thank Have you. You always been like that? Like, was there a time in your life where you just got very down about these things, or have you always had this strength? Because some people, they...
Well, I'm going to accept your compliment and then move on. I give credit to my parents, particularly my mother. My mother always saw the positive in things. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe excessively so, but there's, you know, and some people would say that's denial or a form of mental illness, but it will also get you through tough times. And there's been these studies that show that people who are optimists do get through crisis through greater percentages than people who focus on the negative. You have to. Mm-hmm. It's a survival technique. It can also overlive its usefulness if it enables you to not see how truly horrible a situation is. But I think that we're all luckier than we realize. I think it's very easy to focus on the negative, and especially with social media, and there's so many horrible things going on in the world right now. And somebody told me recently, you know, bad things happen suddenly, but good things happen in increments. And I think that, I think, and this is not to deny all the awful things that are going on in the world, but if we can focus on some of the wonderful things that are happening, that gives us the hope to go on.
Mm-hmm. I like that. So with this positive outlook that you have, is that what helped you forgive your parents, or have you always just kind of forgiven them?
It's not a matter, to me, it's not a matter of forgiveness. It's acceptance. My mother cannot take care of herself. How could she take care of me? She just, she can't function.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe because it's so extreme, it's just something I realized way early on, this woman is not going to feed me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm either going to learn to feed myself or go hungry. It's, you know, if I'm sitting there angry, or Mom, give me food, I might as well be asking a duck for food. It's just not going to happen. You learn to go elsewhere very early on. She still makes me a little crazy sometimes. By the way, she's working on her own version of the Glass Castle right now, so it will, but she doesn't like to rewrite, so it won't take her a long time. But she, you know, she sees the world differently. That's okay. With my father, it's I think it's more complicated because I had more hope mm-hmm. in him. I had more belief in him, and he just kept on dropping the ball and breaking my heart time and time again. It's not forgiveness. It was finally turning into an adult and realizing he doesn't have it in him. He mm-hmm. cannot give this to me. This thing, he is not going to protect me. He's not going to build me a glass castle. He's going to take me down with him, and mm-hmm. I have to get away. So that's not a matter of forgiveness. It's a matter of self-preservation and realizing if I stay in my father's world with me, he'll take me to bars. He, on some level, wanted me, I believe, to become an alcoholic. He would have fought it as well. He would have told me not to drink, but it's very complicated. And I just realized kind of early on, I got to get away.
Yeah.
And so whatever damage I carry around, I mean, I'm very tough. I'm a survivor. But I have a streak of selfishness, self-preservation. And I think a lot of people who are survivors have that as well. And, you know, we carry around a little bit of guilt for that. And I think the person I had to forgive was myself. And I did that by telling my story because readers saw me more clearly than I see myself.
That's amazing. So when you were saying that you knew you had to get away, mm-hmm. when was that turning point for you? When did it stop being an adventure?
13, and then age 13.
13?
No question. I mean, 13 was a tough year. and that was the year that my mother went away to get her teaching certificate renewed. And I was in charge of the household. And I thought I could be a better mother than my mother was. I thought I could fix my dad.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I could get him to stop drinking and get our family on a budget and maybe buy us all some new shoes. And in no time, I was giving him beer money. And I realized, yikes, I am not any stronger than my mom. I got to get away. And, you know, I was the only one with a job at that point. I was the only one earning money. Mom quit work when she came back and saw that I could earn money. And I thought, I've got to get out of here. And that's when I hatched the plan for my older sister and me to come to New York.
That's amazing. And then you did it, and you got there.
Which, in retrospect, I can't believe I did it. It didn't seem that hard. People were sort of like, that must have been so difficult. Not compared to what I'd been through.
Yeah.
It was sort of easy by comparison, to tell you the truth. Because my older sister and I, we lived in the South Bronx, but we had running water.
Mm-hmm.
We had heat. We had a thermostat. You just move this little thing and it got warm. Wow, this is so easy. I was working three jobs, but I could eat.
Yeah.
For the first time in my life, the cops weren't chasing us. I could sleep through the night because I had warm covers. I had a heating system. I could get up in the morning and turn on a faucet and there's fresh cold water or hot water to take a bath. I will never take a shower for granted.
Mm-hmm.
I will never look at these things and grumble to myself. I mean, every time I turn on the shower, I feel overwhelmed by gratitude that I have such luxuries.
Yeah, because you didn't have that for such a long time.
Yes.
And then
yes,
one day you finally moved out. What kept you motivated so long to get you to New York? Was it the fact that you didn't have the running water, the food, the resources? How'd you manage that?
I'm going to be annoying.
That's okay.
And give my father credit mm-hmm. for all that he didn't do, for all the horrible things he did to us and to the family. He gave me a belief in myself. With a glass castle, he made me believe that I deserved something better than what I had.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time that he was taking away the physical comforts of my life, he was providing me with this emotional sustenance and this dream, and this vision for the future.
Was it hard for you to keep that dream, though? Because there was times where he stole money from you when you were trying to get away.
There was nothing that was going to keep me from getting away. If I had to, like, if he cut off my legs, I would have got on a skateboard and paddled my way. I was going to get to New York City. I was going to get to a place where a journalist could make a living,
mm-hmm.
where the AP was, where the UPI was, where Time Magazine and Newsweek were, and people could make a, you could actually get paid for being a writer. I was going to do that, and nothing was going to stop me.
Yeah, understandably so. So even though your childhood was much different from other children's, mm-hmm. what is that memory that you think of the most when you think back on your childhood?
Getting a star for Christmas.
Yeah, that stuck out to me in the book.
Yeah, that's, and it's something I think of at least once a day. Because
mm-hmm.
I go out every evening, I take an evening walk, and I always look for Venus.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of gift that makes it okay for me to still love my father, despite all the horrible things he did. And I am fully aware of that. I'm not in denial that
he was a
no-count alcoholic scoundrel. He stole money. He did bad things,
mm-hmm.
but he was damaged.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody once told me we become adults not when we are old enough to vote or when we're old enough to drink or even when we have all our own children. It's when we realize that our parents were flawed human beings as well. And that they have their issues, and you can accept them for who and what they were. And that doesn't mean approve of what they did,
mm-hmm.
but to understand that this was not about me. My father didn't steal my money because he didn't like me or because he's a bad man. He had issues, and did with my mother. She cannot take care of herself. It's okay. It's not about me. Get on with your life, Jeanette. Stop, like, looking backwards. I heard a phrase one time that I love. Don't trip on something behind you.
Yes.
You know, and if I'm just looking back at all of this stuff that was done to me and being angry about it. Now, that being said, it's ironic that I went and wrote the whole book because I am looking back and I'm tripping on stuff behind me. But it's to understand better.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm such a proponent of telling your story because then you kind of own it. I didn't know my story until I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
First time I read it back, I was a little shocked.
Yeah.
I don't think I realized quite how extreme it was because I tucked it away in little places where I didn't really want to deal with it. I knew it, but I didn't really look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And the process of writing, it forces you to go into those dark corners and shine a light and take them out and kind of dust them off. And they're kind of ugly at first, but you really have to examine them. And
mm-hmm.
what really happened? And how did I really feel about it? And am I being honest here? Am I glossing over? I realize the degree to which I use humor to try to cover things up. That, you know, there are a couple of things I kind of skirted over. I didn't really want to talk about them. And my husband forced me to be honest. He said, you're not being, spend a little more time discussing what happened there. I said, nothing happened there. It was fine. Nothing happened at all. You know, so,
yeah.
And I also realized that I used journalism to distance myself.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote, the first version I wrote is so it happened to somebody else. I'd written a very stilted, very sort of matter of fact,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that I used journalism for so much of my life to protect myself, to be the person on the edge of the crowd watching other people do things,
yeah,
so that the focus wouldn't be on me, it would be on other people's stories. And I think that to a degree it was, you know, trying to tell myself everybody has a story. But that being said, if I'm being completely honest, there's probably a level of schadenfreude as well. That's even somebody as fabulous and beautiful as Nicole Kidman's got problems too. But kind of shame on me for doing that for so long while I was trying to deflect from my own story.
So do you feel that writing it helped you heal in a sense?
Oh, my goodness. It was the most cathartic thing I've ever done in my life.
I'm sure.
It was so healing. It was so therapeutic. And it's something that I recommend to people, but you have to spend some time with it. You can't just write it down one time. You have to really get into it and be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also kind of fascinating as somebody who just had spent so much of my career writing short, snarky paragraphs, turning my family's life into a story. And you have to, there's a beginning, middle, and end, and the people are characters. It's not just my family. And some things that I thought were perfectly normal, my husband said, that's not so normal, Jeanette. No. And some things I thought were completely weird and outrageous, that happens to everybody. So my understanding, because I was so isolated, and I hadn't told people about my story, to sit down and examine it and look at it as a story. And then you ask yourself also, what is this story? Originally, I thought it was going to focus a lot more on the New York City years.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that I was going to focus a lot more on my wacky relatives and the crazy, you know, alcoholic preacher who married the hooker. Blah, blah, blah. And that's somebody else's story. And I had to tell my story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's very, very interesting. When you said that it took you some time to like edit the book, it took you a couple years to edit
it, didn't it? 5 years rewriting. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Is that because you wanted to make sure you were honest with yourself?
Yes, that was. It's also finding your voice, which is a real challenge for any writer. And it's less of a challenge if you're writing an autobiography than you're writing a memoir. You really have to sort of find yourself, be true to yourself. That's part of being honest, is finding your voice. And at one point I was reading Frank McCourt, who, of course, wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir. Mm-hmm. He was Irish. And I found while I was reading Frank McCourt that Blarney was creeping into my writing. It was like, you know, and I don't talk like this. So I found that I couldn't read anything else while I was writing, because you have to be true to your voice. And I talked to Frank McCourt about it, and he said he was reading James Joyce while he was trying to write his, and realized he was doing these endless sentences, and he doesn't write like that either. So that's one of the things I tell people when you're writing your stories. Be true to who and what you are. Now, the first version, I said it was sort of, it was written in bad journalism-ese, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, I'd heretofore not consider the plethora of influences. And it was, you know, I was emotionally distancing myself. And my agent said, you've wrapped it in cellophane.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be able to touch it and smell it. And I found that whenever I wrote it as an adult looking back, I would lapse into this sort of analyzing, psychological, you know, armchair psychologizing. And only by trying to go back and be a child and describe what it felt like could I be kind of emotionally true and honest and not pass judgment on my parents. Because I think that 5- and 6-year-old children, at least when I was a 5- and 6-year-old child, I didn't pass judgment on my parents. I accepted this bizarre world as real.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that that was the best way to capture the voice, is to try to remember what it felt like. Remember, because I adored both of my parents, but especially my father. Meanwhile, the readers are knowing that, Jeanette, this is not so perfect. I'm thinking, you know, I'm writing, my dad's so perfect. We got to go travel around and don't have to use pillows. This is so great. And of course, the parents, the readers realize, no, it's not. And so it's, you know, unintentionally, I'm an unreliable narrator. But I, being really honest about what happened and to answer one of your earlier questions, when did it really start seeping in that this wasn't, not only wasn't okay, it wasn't acceptable, and I had to get out, and which incidents? It was funny because recalling the incidents wasn't difficult, but putting them in order was.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because I remember the anecdotes so clearly, but did this happen in Blue, you know, were we in Blythe then, or were we in Battle Mountain? And then, we had that car, and I fell out there, so it must have been there. So that was the larger challenge. And people have asked me, how could you possibly remember all of these things? The stories were easy to remember, but the sequence, it was sort of like, sometimes it was a bit of a blur about, I think we were living there, this must have happened there. So I had to kind of do a timeline.
Yeah.
And there were so many times that were so chaotic, and we'd run into the car and things would happen again. And there were a number of incidents that I cut out just because it happened several times. You don't need to keep on reading about dad's drunken episodes. So that was another reason it took 5 years, just honing down the story. Well, what is the story? What is the beginning, middle, and end? And how do I really feel about these really complicated people?
Yeah, and that's understandable. You did move around so many times. It's probably very easy to get that confused and not really know which part was which. And you were young, too.
I was very young. And the burn, I remember so clearly. And I remember how old I was, because the doctors made such a big deal out of me being only 3 years old. So I remember I had to have been 3, you know, and my brother can remember that incident as well. But he's over, you're younger than I, but he said, I can remember I could stand. He remembers flashes of it. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, after the burn, things got a little, and I think the books get a little, gets a little sort of, a little more discombobulated because things got a little blurry and until the star. And I remember exactly how old I was there. So, because it was such a big deal for my fifth. So you find these little things that you can cling to. And people have asked me, well, how much did you make up? None. Mm-hmm. You don't make anything up.
Yeah.
That's a violation. That's called fiction, you mm-hmm. know. And people say, well, aren't you given a little leeway? You can change people's names. I have no problem with that, changing people's names or identifying characteristics to protect people's privacy. But we don't lie in a memoir. We tell our stories. There's a trust that goes on. And once you start lying, you break that trust.
Mm-hmm. Understandable. Now, going back to your childhood a little bit, were you ever mad that your mom didn't sell that $1 million property and help you guys out just a little?
I was bewildered. Yeah, I was frustrated. Mm-hmm. But this is one of the reasons that I love doing book tours and stuff. I was, somebody said, your mother could have sold that land. Y'all would have had a normal life. And another woman in the audience, she stands up and said, if she would have sold that land, that no good husband would have got his mitts on the money. It would be gone in a 3-day bender. And she's right. It would have been. We wouldn't. And now we still have the land. So it doesn't matter. Am I mad about it now? Not in the least. I am the luckiest person in the world. And if I'd had a normal childhood, I couldn't have written the book.
Mm-hmm. So, even though as a child, though, you weren't mad about it then, or?
As a child, I don't think I understood. As a child, I didn't want the life to change. As a 13-year-old, yeah, I wanted her to sell it. Mm-hmm. I wanted a normal life. As a 13, 12, 13, 14-year-old, this is ridiculous, Mom.
Yeah.
This is just this is unacceptable. Leave Dad. We can have a normal life. You've got a college education. And she just came up with excuses. And I wasn't mad. I was frustrated. It was mm-hmm. sort of like, this just doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't need to be living like this. It's not so bad, but she's still the same way. Mm-hmm. She's still the same way. And I've hired this woman to help me deal with Mom. Mom, she kind of takes care of Mom because I think I'd probably kill her if it was okay. but she gets frustrated with her too. My mom won't throw out rotten food. She'll just sit there eating it. Oh, it's not so bad. You just cut off the moldy parts. You don't have to eat like this, Mom. You know this. Oh, people today are so fussy. What's wrong with? And it's just like this possum comes into her house and sits on the coffee table and starts eating the food, and she'll like eat around it. And it's like, Mom, that is disgusting. Okay. And she goes, oh, people are so fussy about possums. Why are people so prejudiced against them? They're kind of cute. They've got those little hands that look just like people. I'm like, Mom, that's gross. Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm not a picky eater. I'm mm-hmm. not a germaphobe. Okay. But even I have limits. Yeah. And I start yelling at her, and that's why I need to have this woman who's just lovely and deals with her. But so I'm not going to stand here and pretend that, you know, I've completely come to terms with everything about Mom. She makes me nuts still. I mean, she's sort of like, but that's the way she is. And I will say in her defense, she never, ever criticizes me, ever. I cannot think of a single time that she has ever criticized me. And the person who pointed that out was a psychologist at an event I went to. He said, for whatever Jeanette's parents did wrong, they never humiliated her. They never tore her down.
Mm-hmm.
They always built them up. And it was interesting because the director of the movie, he also commented on that. He said, your mother is positive about everybody and everything. She loves everyone and everything. And that is her blessing. That is the way that, you know, she can be very neat about certain things. She makes me nuts. But she loves life.
Yeah.
She never complains. She's never unhappy. And my husband loves her for that because he's got the perfect. His mother died a couple of years ago, but she was the perfect mom. She was, you know, the diplomat's wife. She was always impeccably dressed. But there were certain things we didn't do. We don't dress like that. We don't do, you know. And she's like most moms. He's never met anybody like Mom. She just walks in with paint all over her. She doesn't, nothing bothers her. Everything's great. She loves everybody and everything. And there's a certain beauty in that. If you can accept it, if you're not looking for her to take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
When I was looking for her to take care of me, it was maddening. And the upside of that is I learned to take care of myself.
Yeah.
you know? And so when I went away to Barnard, it was kind of shocking to me. I was sort of, I was like the old lady, the grand old dame of, you know, because these people had these problems. They say, oh, go to Jeanette. She can fix anything. You know, nothing bothers her, you know? And so that's the upside. I mean, when I went to Barnard, all of my classmates were homesick. I didn't have that problem.
Yeah.
You know, this is good. This is easy. So there is an upside to everything.
Yeah. And like you kind of pointed it out a little bit. You've kind of always been very independent. Like,
always.
Even at the beginning of the book, you were making hot dogs by yourself when you were, how old were you?
Three. And, you know, and again, I wouldn't recommend raising children that way, but I think there's something to be said for giving kids a little more independence, for letting them fail, for letting them see what they're made of. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think my parents carried it way too far, but I am not afraid of a new situation, of a new challenge, of cooking hot dogs. It's a balance. Everything in life is a balance.
Do you have any advice for somebody in like a situation like this? Because I'm sure that you're not the only person who's gone through this.
First of all, trust yourself. Trust yourself. Trust your judgment. You're stronger than you realize. And I actually believe that those of us who've been through tough times are the lucky ones, because we are given such tools that come in handy down the road. You might, it doesn't seem like it now, but life throws you curveballs. And if you learn to deal with the difficult situation that you have now, life gets a lot better. Mm-hmm. People tell you, you know, oh, these are the best years of your life. Not for all of us. For some of us, it gets a lot better from here. Mm-hmm. And those of us who had really crappy childhoods, we never miss being a kid. So that's one of the good things, that, you know, just tough it out. It will be okay if you will let it. If you will, you know, don't, and this is very important. Do not blame yourself. Do not think that because of your bad situation, that somehow makes you less of a person. The fact that you are living without some of the niceties that maybe some of your friends or classmates have, it doesn't matter. It really and truly doesn't. And anybody who thinks that it does is confused about what really matters in life. Mm-hmm. Down the road, you'll be able to get whatever it is that you want. But right now, you're learning about what it is that does matter. And just tough it out, believe in yourself, and take notes. You might have a good memoir one of these days.
I like it. So what would you say your best year of your life has been so far?
Oh, the last year. No, it just keeps getting better. I keep on saying, it's got to go downhill from here. Last year was just spectacular. I can't believe how beautiful my life is. Mm-hmm. It just keeps getting better. I know it's got to, pretty soon, it can't keep going up. But, you know, before I wrote my memoir, I thought like, well, you know, it's got to go down. Got to start getting bad. I'll help it along. I'll write this memoir that'll like expose me, and I'll be the source of, you know, shame and ridicule. And it got better. Wow. Okay, now I got to go back to my job. And the book kept selling, and these things kept happening. And I was afraid to quit my job, but I did. And now I do things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Life is good, and it just keeps getting better.
It's very rewarding.
Yeah.
So towards the end of the book, your younger sister kind of drifts off.
Yeah.
Whatever happened with her?
You know, I really wrestled with how to tell Maureen's story. And that's one of the reasons that it did take as long as it did, because I kept on putting stuff in, taking it out. My agent said, it's Maureen's story, not yours. Maureen, one of the reasons I didn't write about what happened to her is because she kind of dropped out of the family. She lives on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
One of the many wonderful things that's happened since I wrote the book, and because of having written the book, is our relationship has completely rekindled itself. And I talk to her on a regular basis. And she's fragile. Maureen mm-hmm. is not going to set the world on fire with her career. She's living in a clean, safe place.
Mm-hmm.
She's damaged by our childhood. So all this stuff that I'm saying about that it makes you stronger, not necessarily. You know, it can damage people. And I think particularly the sensitive, porous ones, the ones who are more influenced by their environment. I'm kind of flinty and hard, but it hurt Maureen more. And I don't know why. I don't know if it's because she's more sensitive or because the neighbors took such care of her that she got the toxic quality of our family without the survival skills. Or was it birth order? She was so much younger than the rest of us. I don't know. But for whatever reason, she didn't fare as well as the other three, but she's okay. And she liked the book and loved the movie.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think it was ever, because she was the only sibling left alone with your parents.
You guys
all moved out. Do you think that ever played
a
role?
I don't know. But when she moved to New York, she moved back in with them. Once they moved to New York. I mean, she wanted to be taken care of.
Okay.
Maureen wanted parents.
Mm-hmm.
And she couldn't accept the fact that these people wouldn't take care of her. She just kept on going back to this empty well, trying to find water, and it just wasn't there.
Hoping for
more. Just hoping that, like, okay, folks, you know, man up and be parents, and they wouldn't.
Yeah.
And it made her nuts, or whatever made her nuts. She just kind of, like, went off the deep end, and I don't know exactly what it was, but she could not let go of this. She wanted this place of sanctuary. She wanted to be taken care of. She just could not understand why they wouldn't take care of her. And she now refers to my mother and father by their first names. And I said, why do you not call mom? She goes, because I don't have a mother. And I get it.
Mm-hmm.
I get it. I don't agree, but I totally get it. It was very hard on her.
Mm-hmm. Do you think your book in any way could help her heal?
I do. She told me it's helped her a lot. She says, I see things a little differently. You know, I mean, it's so funny because Maureen had friends, you know. She was so pretty. But I think that there's just a lot of issues that Maureen is. I've been trying to get her to come live with me in Virginia. And she says she never wants to live where it's cold ever again. And I said, you know, the cold's not so bad when you got a thermostat. It's just like, it's warm real quick. And she said, I almost froze to death. She said, I have nightmares about it. And it's funny because, again, you know, two children who went through the exact same thing. I love the cold.
Mm-hmm.
I love a fireplace. I love the seasons. I love it that I have this cozy house. I can take a hot bath at night. Maureen cannot get cold. It freaks her out.
Mm-hmm.
So I get it. Even my brother says that sometimes he just feels like a piece of food that wasn't defrosted properly. It's still kind of frozen inside. And they both carry around the memory of being that cold. I carry around the memory of, like, yeah, beat that cold, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, the same memory, but what do you choose to focus on?
Mm-hmm. Are you still close? Is the family still very close-knit?
We're pretty close. I mean, I talk to Lori a couple of times a month. I talk to my brother a couple of times a week.
Mm-hmm.
Maureen a couple of times a month. I mean, we talk. The conversations with Maureen are a little limited.
Mm-hmm.
Her reference points are a little skewered, but, you know, she's a sweet person. But Brian and I have conversations that go on for hours. He's the smartest person I've ever, with a possible exception of my mother. I can't believe my mom's as smart as she is. She's so daffy. I was reading this book, and it was about the invention of the telephone, and Mom knew all these details. I was reading the book, and she could remember more things than I did. I said, Mom, how can you remember all of this stuff? And you don't know my birthday. She has no idea what my birthday is. She goes, I don't find your birthday particularly interesting.
And
whatever she finds interesting, she retains.
Huh.
And that's often the case with hoarders. They're often hoarders of information as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when they find something fascinating, they never let go. I mean, she remembers details from books she read 50 years ago. I don't have that kind of memory, and I'm kind of jealous of it. But like I said, on the other hand, she can't remember her own Social Security number.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating to me, but it's the way her brain works. And I can't get mad at her for that.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of funny. She said, you were born, I think, maybe sometime in the spring. It was kind of warm, I believe. You know, so it's like, it's okay, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's all right.
And both your parents were pretty smart, too. Like,
really smart.
Yeah, because your father taught you most of what you know or knew.
Well, and also, I mean, I wondered if it was my imagination, but in fact, when I moved my mom, she lives with me in Virginia now, and I went through her stuff, and I found some of my father's old writings, and he was a genius. His math, I mean, it looks like gobbledygook to me, but I've shown it to some mathematicians. They said, no, he's really smart.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just on this level that I don't get. I am, I, I color inside the lines, okay? I'm not an idiot, but my brain doesn't work like that.
Yeah, no, mine doesn't either. It's okay. I've never been a math person. But yeah, it's always been so interesting to me that your dad was so intelligent.
So brilliant.
And then
I think that very often these people who are off the chart brilliant are also a little nutty. Mm-hmm. And almost by definition, you almost have to be. You look at the number of people, number of geniuses who've been posthumously diagnosed as being bipolar, almost by definition, for your mind to go places that other people's can't, you don't think the same way that the pedantic, you know, people such as myself do. And, you know, he was tortured. And I accept that. And I admire what was good about him.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I just got a note that we have to wrap it up soon. So do you have anything else that you would like to say to the listeners out there?
I just want to say how thrilled I am to be here. I love the one book program, even when they don't choose my book as a program. I think it's I love it more when they choose my book. But this will sound hokey, but it really is an honor. Nothing makes me happier than talking about the book with students, answering their difficult questions, and just sharing. It's all about storytelling, and I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we're very honored to have you, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
You're listening to 90.3 WESSE Stroudsburg University, East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, and what you just heard was probably one of the best interviews I've listened to in a long time between our one book, one campus author, Jeanette Walls, and The Glass Castle was the book that was chosen for the One Book, One Campus. And we are very thankful that she gave Anya her time to be interviewed. And we'll have another book on our campus from you in the near future. So thank you very much for showing up and being interviewed. And here's the BBC.